Is there a place in time where logic breaks down and wonderment begins? Could that be somewhere or sometime along an indefinable line between the reasonable and the highly unlikely? Makeshift Stories presents a monthly journey into the improbable.
Today's story, episode 225, The Great Moon Hoax. Read by Mitchell Two. Opening and closing theme by Matthew Erdman. Somewhere and sometime, a hoax might be an attempt at distraction rather than deceit.
It is with much humility, and possibly a touch of regret, that I wish to admit causing humanity to miss, or at least be ignorant of, one of the greatest opportunities the universe has presented to the sentience of this diminutive world in many a millennium. I write this now, on the dawn of the century number 20, according to the Gregorian calendar, although my deed took place in the first half of the 19th, in the year numbered 35. Now, having been almost 64 years past, even my exceptional memory dulls. So, of necessity, some detail may be lacking, or, where absolutely necessary to create a cohesive record, be made of imagination rooted in good intention. It is thus that I want to take you, dear reader, back to the year 1835 of the Common Era. In many ways, both an exceptional year and a very common one. The first photographic negative was exposed at Lecoq Abbey. The Staedtler Company made its first pencil. Charles Darwin arrived at the Galapagos Islands aboard HMS Beagle. A great conflagration consumed New York, and a railway was opening in Belgium, the first on the continent of Europe. There were revolutions, conquests, wars, births, inventions, and deaths, some of which were documented by the writers of history, some well known, others wanting to be, and many simply contracted or commanded to bury facts of inconvenience and create writs of a fictional nature for those things which could not be smothered. Thus, 1835 was just a year, like any other. However, be it that during those 12 months, the comet, which, unbeknownst to itself, bears the name of the English astronomer and friend of Newton, who first calculated the heavenly body's periodicity, slipped past perihelion, mostly unnoticed. At least not by immense telescopes of an entirely new principle, of which our spy had informed us. Most, dear reader, had pointed their misplaced curiosity elsewhere, to wit, the moon, the reason for which I will get to in the course of this missive. Having accepted this very sortie on the first new moon of 1835, I found few courses of action, so, lest I descend to the depravity of murder, a course of deception lay before me. In this endeavor, I created a most novel character of fiction, one Dr. Andrew Grant, a scribe and close friend of the eminent Sir John Herschel, an eminent and respected English academician of the day, a mathematician of great regard, but, most important for my cunning, an astronomer, president of the Royal Astronomical Society, and experimenter in the new field of photochemical imaging. Of particular importance to my method, in fact, much relied on this truth, was the velocity at which a message in those days traveled on the oceans of the world. Communiques were limited to the speed of sail, which afforded my deception time to prosper. Sir John Herschel was in Cape Town at the date in question, observing the southern skies, and Dr. Grant I created as a resident of New York. Thus, assured of the tardiness of letters, I penned a dispatch to Mr. Richard Adams Locke, an ambitious scribe in the newly minted field of reportage. I had chosen Mr. Locke and his then-employer, the Sun newspaper of the great city of New York, naturally pre-fire, very carefully. Both possessed the hunger of a starving jackal and the ambition of a newly minted politician. To wit meant they would be very much prone to an exploitation which promised much fame, notoriety, and power of influence. My letter went as follows. Dear Sir, by way of introduction, I am Andrew Grant, Doctor of Letters and scribe to the President of the Royal Astronomical Society, Sir John Herschel himself. As such, on occasion, I am privy to new knowledge yet to be common, and it is on that very premise which I humbly take pen to paper and contact you now. I am of firm belief that which I am about to reveal is of such magnitude as to ascertain a large circulation for your employer's new broadsheet, and bestow a degree of notoriety on yourself, as fitting a great reporter such as you. You will discover what I am about to reveal is incredible, a marker in history as significant as the boundary between the Corman era and before. I do not know what the new era will be called, but you, sir, will be the one always associated with its start. I would humbly suggest the title of your monumentous article, which you will base on my report, to be Great Astronomical Discoveries Lately, Made by Sir John Herschel at the Cape of Good Hope. I can personally assure you the intelligence I am about to supply is equal to that which Mr. Herschel has transmitted to the Royal Society. Those documents, currently before a committee of learned members, are only different in mathematical, scientific, and mechanical detail, which would not be of general interest to your readers. My friend and colleague, the great astronomer, recently wrote me of the completion of an apparatus of his own design, using new principles just discovered. He has turned his amazing instrument to the scrutiny of the firmament, and it almost instantly revealed that which has been hidden by the veil of immense distance from the eyes of all who have lived since the birth of time on this world. The young Herschel's device, which can bring close the cosmos such that it is equivalent to the viewing of heavenly bodies with the naked eye at a distance of only 2 yards, has observed objects on the moon, affirmatively resolving the question of whether our satellite is inhabited. Yes, this is hard to believe. However, I am confident a brief description of the device will waylay any concern of authenticity and make ready your mind for the radical revelations which follow. It is well known the elder Herschel's 40-foot reflector telescope, being made of a 4-foot mirror made of speculum with arsenic added to improve the finish, suffered from the known principle of physics, whereby nearer objects appear darker the more magnification is enforced, owing to diminution of light from ever smaller areas. The younger solved this problem with a mechanical contrivance of parabolic and spherical reflectors, affording a magnification of the moon and other solar objects at hitherto unseen magnifications, which, given the distance to the moon, afforded a view much the same as looking down at Geneva from the top of an adjacent mountain peak. That is, using the Elder's existing ponderous instrument. Previously, the Elder Herschel had been limited to a power of less than 1,000 times, so he could discern objects of not more than 122 yards across on our satellite. Yet, even at such a great magnification, objects still appeared as feeble shapes of little conspicuity. Having solved the problem of the diminution of light from nearby solar bodies, the younger made plans, calculations, and adaptations for a 24-foot diameter lens, which, when finally cast and polished, weighed a gargantuan 8 tons. Some have estimated the magnifying power of the Younger's impressive apparatus to be tens of thousands of times, and ought to be capable of a resolution such that Herschel possesses the ability to study the entomology of the moon, should he so choose. With the minutest designs of his plans being intensely studied and executed with all due haste, the Younger accepted a commission and arranged conveyance of his colossal instrument to its destination. I spent some time at this point in the missive to describe in detail the maths, sciences, and engineerings of the final apparatus, of which interest is only for those with such an inclination, or need to be convinced of the probity of my story. The latter being my intent, for Mr. Locke and his editors to find no lacking in scientific and logical palpability. Indeed, I wished to overwhelm their minds with facts so close to possibility they could not easily refute, and, blinded by the attraction of notoriety and wealth from the sale of many broadsheets, would not bother to investigate with any veracity. Now, a point of historical fact. The many tendrils of my cunning mendacity succeeded beyond expectation, as evidenced by a simple observation of historical manuscripts from the year 1835. Few make reference to, or notation of, the passing of the comet, commonly known as Halley. No document, albeit at least one keen eye, which, truth be told, belonged to yours truly, may have borne witness to our departure from the great comet as a splinter of glorious brilliant light at perihelion. Thus, taking advantage of the immense velocities granted by the attraction of the sun, our heavenly conveyance was catapulted out of the solar system, not to return. You, the reader, may have already conjectured my commission did not include passage back to the firmament, and accounts for the eventual need to carefully prepare this humble document, whose intent is to but correct a footnote in your history, which I shall now get back to the business of setting down in words for all prosperity. Having prepared the intellect of my target to accept my diversion, I went on to expound the gravity of the great apocryphal discovery, to which my spurious Dr. Andrew Grant had been enlisted to communicate as follows. Being offered advantageous conditions on the Cape of Good Hope to observe the transit of Mercury across the Sun from the southern hemisphere, for which it would be possible to extract the exact great solar parallax and thus determine the precise distance of all the planets from the Sun, the young Herschel accepted a royal commission. Dr. Herschel soon arrived with a cadre of English mechanics of an unmatched caliber, after an expeditious and uneventful trip. Immediately, work commenced on the erection of a prodigious structure to contain the massive lens, the intensity and scale of which the Cape had never seen before or hence. Shortly thereafter, observation began, subsequent to many tunings and fine adjustments of this most magnificent and rare specimen of philosophical mechanisms. The instrument promptly and rightly fermented the discovery of many new stars and nebulae, which I shall not get into here, as that would constitute a distraction and delay the telling of the grand discovery, which is, after all, the reason for my missive. Dr. Herschel will, at a time of his choosing, catalogue these numerous detections for the Royal Society to ponder. Until the 4th of May, observations were chiefly of distant celestial bodies, and, as I have thoroughly established, many new discoveries were made. At that point, the great astronomer turned his magnificent instrument to Luna herself, newly minted as a full golden orb 2 days prior to her fall. Due to the rapidity of the Earth's diurnal rotation, at such a magnification, being of 495 yards per second, most instruments would only produce a blur unless somehow steadied. However, ingenious mechanisms held the gargantuan telescope in such perfect synchronicity that Herschel could detain any part of Luna's surface in the field of view for any length desired. This facilitated in deep scrutiny of the objects interrogated by the great lens. Almost immediately revealed was a rocky ledge covered partially with a profusion of purple flowers, not so much dissimilar to many herbaceous plants already known here. To wit, excitement overran all manner of engineer and assistant, as such vegetation had decided the question of atmosphere, which, due to the flowers, was certainly similar to our own, and accomplished at supporting organized life and, therefore, fauna. In succession, so furious a dozen scriveners could barely keep up, the field of view drifted over forests of wondrous tree-like plants unseen before, then rivers, valleys, lakes, and many other landforms. You will appreciate these discoveries on their own are of such magnitude as to force a rewrite of all botanical thesis to date. But this was just the beginning. At such prodigious magnification, the area which fell upon the field of view was that of two ox carts. The resolution, while exquisite, maintained such a great limit on exploration. A whole night of observation yielded an examination of less than one city block. Wearied by the prospect of a long continuance, Dr. Herschel reduced the magnification. Consequent to the removal of several magnifying elements, it became immediately apparent he had been crawling, as it were, the highly diversified and maudlin architecture of a garden, not entirely unlike the one of Rousham House in Oxfordshire. And, if truth be told, this garden put William Kent's design to shame. Use of the feeblest magnification possible brought an area of a great metropolis into frame, and, toward the left edge, a magnificent temple did appear. Based, in part, on the color of the stone used, Herschel named this monumental urban construction the Ruby Berghall, as one could not imagine it as anything other than a great city-state. I must stop at this point, as we are coming to the climax of this humble correspondence, and point out I have omitted much of the wondrous fauna and flora discovered, which I will describe assiduously in subsequent correspondence, should you and your employer be of the mind to publish such. For now, I will only describe the majestic humanoids which populate, and we were sanguine to consider, the builders of said great city. I realize this news is astonishing, even for those of a receptive mind. Herschel first happened on one of these most ethereal creatures, he forthwith scientifically denominated as Vespertilio Homo, or Batman, which, as you will soon discover, is most befitting. From the perspective of 1/2 mile, he was thrilled and astonished to perceive what he thought of as a flock of winged creatures, not thoroughly like birds of any kind. Gliding on great wings, they descended in an even and organized manner with majestic alacrity to the base of the temple, where they stood like human beings, erect, and bore the dignity of intelligent thought. Herschel ordered more lenses inserted, which brought us to a distance of 80 or so yards. At such a close regard, it could be made out that the creatures had a stature of less than 4 feet, and were covered, except for the face, with fine, glossy, golden-brown hair. Their wings appeared made of a thin membrane and folded such that they almost disappeared. Their faces could be said to be human, but nonetheless similar to a large orangutan, however, with significantly more expression of intelligence. They proceeded to walk about their business in a very human-like manner. we watched a small group of these natural aeronauts form to engage in conversation. Through the gesticulation of hand and arms, they were evidenced to be impassioned and emphatic. Thus, it was concluded they were beings of rational thought. Later, this inference was confirmed when one was spotted painting a fresco on the wall, proving they were capable of producing art and other contrivances. I will stop here, as I believe adding further detail will not immeasurably add to the general interest you might have in this historic discovery. Trusting I have enticed your professional curiosity, I patiently await your reply. Ever yours, Andrew Grant, Doctor of Letters. Mr. Locke and his editors proved to be as ambitious and hungry as I had surmised. Upon receiving my letter, the esteemed reporter responded with great haste and enthusiasm, requesting details of the moon's fauna, flora, and the social life of the Vespertilio Homo. I obligingly and enthusiastically contrived such detail, placing an emphasis on the latter, which, suspecting a sense of voyeurism, would achieve considerable interest in the readers of the broadsheet, who, mostly being new to the skill of literacy, would not attack the facts with any degree of competence. This proved to be true, for, as a series of 6 articles, each one more provocative to scientific reason than the last, came out in August of 1835, all eyes, so to speak, shifted to the moon. That was until word of the general uproar provoked, along with numerous requests for even more salacious descriptions of the lives of the Vespertilio Homo, reached the shores of the Cape of Good Hope and Dr. Herschel's installation. By the time the denial vigorously suggesting the narrative to be fictitious returned, dear reader, our great departure had transpired. However, as is the profundity of belief, many pairs of eyes continued for months, if not to this very day, to seek out the great lunar city of Ruby Berghall. A fire of convenience in December of the year 1835 consumed the offices of the Sun and 500 other buildings in New York, which, owing to misfortune and the thick ice on the Hudson River, deprived the heroic firefighters of effective recourse, got in the way of the hungry flames. The resulting lack of documentation, printed or written by hand, only served to fuel the imaginations of those determined to continue the futile search. My deception, now 65 orbits past, may arise interrogatories in the reader's mind as to the lot of the author. I must admit, my commission had but a single goal, which was admirably achieved. My persistence on this world, the cost of such an immense success. You might ask, why would we desire to slip away into the cold, dark, unnoticed? In such a case, I pose this to you for your consideration. Why would we travelers, who ply the ether between the bodies of heaven as easily as fieldfares migrate south for the winter, fancy to announce ourselves to a world which believed, and may in certain circles still does, that miasma, a vaporous exhalation of dubious validity, is the cause of cholera, rather than the dumping of sewers into drinking water? However, time hath passed, and I remain, much to my chagrin, the same, forced to take on new personas so as to avoid suspicion that I may have sipped waters from Ponce de Leon's fabled fountain of restorative powers secreted away in Florida. Alas, I wait with no great expectation of extraction. Between what hath been and what will come, to entertain and delight my intellect, I have, and dare say will, from time to time of my choosing, interfere with communication such that the truth not always be known. Keep that in mind, dear reader, as you contemplate the veracity of the past and present.
Makeshift Stories is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. To get other great APN podcasts, head over to albertapodcastnetwork.com, where you'll find Scam Time. Stephanie Wolf and Karen Johnson Diamond gasp and giggle over the topic of frauds and phonies in this true crime comedy podcast. This episode of Makeshift Stories is brought to you by the Alberta Podcast Network. At ATB, we make banking work for you. With expert and practical advice in everyday banking and investment planning expertise and management services with ATB Wealth, you can be confident that you're making smart choices when it comes to your money. We have a history of doing what's right for our clients, especially when times are tough, because ATB was built to help Albertans. For more information, visit atb.com. This episode of Makeshift Stories is also brought to you by the Alberta Podcast Network. APN connects Alberta podcast listeners to businesses and organizations in Alberta and around the world. Podcasters in our network are smart, creative, and engaging, providing an excellent way to reach local listeners and those around the world who enjoy our shows. Send us an email at hello@albertapodcastnetwork.com and we'll help you meet your goals. Makeshift Stories is released around the beginning and middle of the month. This month's story was written by Alan V. Hare and read by Mitchell Too. Post-production by Matthew Erdman. Opening and closing themes were composed and recorded by Matthew Erdman. If you'd like to connect with us, please send an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. Links to both are in the show notes. You can help us out by getting your friends to subscribe or follow wherever they listen to audio. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution No Derivative License, which means you are free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.